From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Okay, last week we started the show with politics, despite a pretty thin media angle, because, come on, it was the Iowa caucuses. But this week, we're doing it again, only this time, I swear, with a much, much better media story. And by better, I mean a pitiful, pathetic New Hampshire primary pundit implosion, a historic Dewey defeats Truman pie in the face, the creamy remnants of which TV stars including CNN's Lou Dobbs, CBS's Katie Couric, and NBC's Brian Williams are still scraping off their kissers.
The savants, the pundits, all of the political experts need to do a little seeking of forgiveness, because everyone was so wrong in this, and breathtakingly so.
We'll be hearing more from those ubiquitous pundits and polls in the weeks ahead. But Iowa and now New Hampshire should remind us all, in the end, the only voice that really matters belongs to the voters.
Give us a few weeks. We'll promptly forget the lessons of this debacle in polling predictions and primary politics. We will all live to screw up another day, though our performance in New Hampshire will be hard to beat.
That was NBC's Brian Williams stating the painfully obvious. They will live to screw up another day because campaign journalism, and especially political punditry, is all about prognostication, a savory soup of polling data, history, and supposed expertise, which is all well and good, except that the electorate doesn't necessarily eat the soup. The experts are still sorting out the polls. Was the sampling unrepresentative? Did the sample lie? Did the human factor, actual living, breathing voters deciding on living, breathing candidates, rudely ignore the inevitability of a Clinton defeat? Even the unsinkable Chris Matthews, MSNBC's towering monument to certainty, seemed a little shaken up, almost a new man. Here he was on Tuesday.
And I give her a lot of personal credit. I will never underestimate Hillary Clinton again.
Well, maybe not entirely new man. Here he was the next day.
And I'll be brutal. The reason she's a U.S. senator, the reason she's a candidate for president, the reason she may be a front runner is her husband messed around.
Yeah, but
that's how she got to be senator from New York. We keep forgetting it. She didn't win there on her merit. She won because everybody felt, my God, this woman stood up under humiliation.
And that is a course on how the media screws up. In fact, it's not just one course. It's a whole meal from soup to nuts.
Christopher Hayes, Washington editor for The Nation, is fresh off the campaign trail. He joins us now, sleep-deprived, and we hope, with his guard down. Chris, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back, Brooke.
So there was an interesting piece of analysis on Campaign Desk, which offers continual coverage of the coverage on the CJR website. And it suggests that the vote for Clinton in New Hampshire was in some way a vote against MSNBC's Chris Matthews as the sort of breathing, saliva-spewing symbol of a general media dump on Hillary. When we talk about groupthink, is he the leader of the pack?
I think he's one of them. I mean, he's certainly the most voluble of the bunch. And I think also the amazing thing about Chris Matthews is that when he gets something in his sights, he just won't let it go. So, I mean, sometimes instead of interviewing him, whatever idea he just came up with, he just sort of throws it out and says, isn't that true? Right. But isn't that true? And then if they try to deviate from the line, he cuts them off and steers them back.
You know, it does seem that he's gotten a lot of the press in the wake of New Hampshire. Is it simply that because his narratives seem to be so immovable once set that he's just, as you say, an example of the extreme campaign reporter?
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. I mean, I think that he's ascended to the level of kind of icon of the frustration that people have with the media, particularly the media's relationship with the Clintons. I actually think that going into Tuesday, before the actual primary had happened, my thought was that the biggest story that I was seeing was this crazy degree of schadenfreude on the part of the National Press Corps directed towards the Clintons. I mean, it was almost like they were gathered on the shore as the Titanic was sinking and kind of sadistically waving at the people scrambling for life rafts. And it was so palpable. It kind of brought people back to the late 1990s and Ken Starr and Monica Lewinsky. And that's a real raw emotional place for your average Democratic primary voter. And I've talked to a lot of people who are not Hillary Clinton supporters at all. And they felt this desire to kind of defend the Clintons and to kind of tell the media to go buzz off.
You've called the experience of covering the New Hampshire primary terrifying, and you wrote that you're convinced that a lot of the reporting that emanates from New Hampshire and Iowa is the result of insecurity that never goes away.
Yeah, it's a bewildering enterprise, right? Very few of the reporters there are from New Hampshire. So you got the GPS in your rental car, and you got a million events to go to. And there's always the fear that you're going to get lost, you're going to go to the wrong thing or cover the wrong candidate, or something is going to happen and you're not going to be there. The other problem, and this gets at the really deep epistemic conundrum of political reporting, which is that ultimately what's going on in an election is happening inside a black box called the voter's head. And as a political reporter, you have this set of remarkably crude tools to try to like peer in there. So what do? You project your own feelings. So I go to an Obama event and I'm like, you know, I get goosebumps and I'm like, wow, he's inspiring everyone. Well, I don't know if he's inspiring everyone. In fact, afterwards at a few events, after I thought, you know, I was ready to go sign up and volunteer for the Obama campaign, I talked to a few people who were like, yeah, well, I'm still thinking of Richardson. Like, Richardson, what are you talking about? Didn't you just see that speech?
You know? You know, it's really interesting because this also, I think, is a contributing factor to this PAC analysis, this groupthink that takes over a campaign or campaign reporters. Ezra Klein, who is a campaign reporter for the American Prospect, wrote in his blog about watching Hillary's debate performance in New Hampshire. He thought she did a great job, but he was soon convinced that she'd actually had a damaging meltdown because the spin was so overwhelming.
You know, there's this distance between you as a reporter and the people at these events or the campaigns. It's just a distance, and you have to overcome it. You have to psych yourself up to go into the crowd and talk to these people who don't necessarily want to talk to a reporter. The easiest people to talk to are other reporters. So you're sort of drawn to them because it requires the least amount of psychological energy. So just the raw minutes you spend talking to reporters versus non-reporters, it starts to get completely out of whack at one of these events. The other thing is that there is safety in numbers. I mean, this is a really obvious point, but I even had someone, a reporter that I know and really respect, said to me afterwards, the morning after, he said, well, I got it wrong, but at least we all got it wrong.
In the wake of Hillary's misty moment and the kind of media interpretation that followed, a lot of media critics invoked the Dean scream. But it's much easier now for the public to actually check the original tape. I mean, people who saw the Dean scream play endlessly on 24-hour cable news could have been forgiven for thinking he was demented. But if the moment was seen at length in the context of the event, supporters shouting, him shouting over them, not to mention that it was the capper of a big go get 'em speech, he wouldn't have seemed so weird.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I think I remember myself seeing the Dean scream and thinking to myself, yeah, he does come off a little unhinged there. And possibly that was because I was, you know, prepared to think that by what I had heard. But then I remember watching this video online that was taken by a supporter in the back of the room with a camcorder. And there was absolutely nothing strange about the whole thing. And so I think the ability to have access, you know, to a kind of a citizen's media of video and to be able to actually go back and see it for yourself is going to be, in the long run, one of many correctives towards this Dean screen phenomena that we see.
But do you think it will make the pundit class more careful?
I would like to say yes, but I think no. And here's the reason why. I really think that the vast majority of members of the political press work very hard and are not these kind of venal, you know, heathers, as they're called sometimes on the blogosphere, these catty high school cliques. But I think fundamentally the problems aren't personality. They're structural. People are set up to fail.
Well, let's talk about those structural problems. I know you've written about possible solutions and you asked the question rhetorically, is good campaign coverage possible?
Yeah, I'm agnostic on the answer, and I say this having just filed a piece from the campaign trail. There's a lot of problems. One is I just think that there's too much quantity right now in political coverage. I mean, the amount that people have to file, the amount of news time that has to be filled, because what happens is when you have to file all the time, you have no time to think. I was on the Edwards bus for 30 hours straight at one point and got back to my room, and I was like, you know what I need to do? I need to spend like 4 hours in front of Google. looking at things and not just the constant perceptual stimulus of the campaign, because I have zero perspective on what I just heard and what just happened. And I need to go and like look at the census data for these towns we were in and actually see what happened with that mill that we just, you know, we just went through. And
you know what you sound like? You sound like people analyzing the reporting from Iraq during the war. You're seeing this campaign through the proverbial soda straw. So do you suggest then that people should rotate on and off campaigns, not be attached to a candidate, but perhaps attached to an issue like immigration or tax policy?
Absolutely. I think that is vitally important. There are people from major networks and newspapers who are embedded with campaigns, and there's benefits. And the benefit is access. You form a relationship, and maybe you can get them to say off the record this or that. But the costs vastly outweigh those benefits. And the costs are that traveling together is deeply intimate. So you're like brushing your teeth next to someone. You're like constantly kind of cramped in these small places with someone. And unless you are a sociopath, you're going to start to have, you know, empathy and a whole host of complicated human feelings towards the people you're covering. Either you're going to get this impacted, dysfunctional, mutual distrust and contempt that you see on the Clinton campaign, or you're going to get this kind of Stockholm syndrome that, you know, arguably—
You see on the McCain campaign.
Right, exactly. On the McCain campaign, it's going to be one or the other, because I can tell you from first person that that does get into your head. I mean, you know, you don't want to make your friend mad at you. The other drawback, the other cost, is the fact that political reporters are not substantive experts. And so whenever they are called to cover something substantive, climate change policy, tax policy, immigration policy, whatever it is, they are going to be vastly, vastly outgunned. Because when you compare the expertise of the person, say, in the Clinton campaign who prepared the Clinton campaign's immigration policy with the expertise of the reporter assigned to cover the Clinton campaign, I mean, it's not even close. Mm-hmm. How do you even know what are the right questions to ask? And when you're on the trail, you don't have a day to spend on the computer and on the phone calling up a lot of immigration experts.
What's the worst thing about campaign coverage right now, especially in the wake of New Hampshire?
Well, it's a combination of the superficiality born of time constraints and a lack of expertise by the people doing the coverage, combined with a herd mentality that is the inevitable result of the terror of being on the campaign trail. Those two things combine to produce coverage that is focused on the most sort of easily parsable aspects of a campaign. How big the crowds are, who cried, who said what, who looked tired, who's got wrinkles, etc. That's the stuff that you can see and you can write right away, and you can talk to your buddy reporter next to you. And so that's what we end up with.
Chris, thank you so much.
Brooke, thanks for having me.
Chris Hayes is the Washington editor of The Nation.
In January of 2007, Los Angeles Times crime reporter Jill Leovi started a blog called The Homicide Report. Her goal was to chronicle every murder day by day in the county of Los Angeles, a region of 4,000 square miles where more than 1,100 people were killed in 2006. When we spoke with Leovi shortly after the beginning of the assignment, she had this to say.
You have to follow the pain. That's the number one rule of homicide reporting. You go for that. You chronicle people's pain. You talk about what this is like.
After a year of chronicling people's pain, Leovi will soon step down as author of the Homicide Report to take more general assignments. She joins us now to reflect on the previous year. Jill, welcome back to On the Media.
Thanks so much, Bob.
On the subject of chronicling people's pain, there is sometimes a thin line between chronicling it and exploiting it. What's the trick to staying on the right side of that line?
And I often say to people, do this only if you want to. Do this if you see a purpose in making people understand what this is like. Don't do it if you find it harmful to yourself in any way or if it feels exploitive to you. I really let my sources steer the ship to a great degree in that regard.
Now, there is a difference between being on the police beat, covering cops and all that comes with it, and chronicling every murder every day for a year. I just can't imagine what kind of toll that takes on you emotionally. What has this exercise been like?
You know, it's funny you should ask me that question about the toll it takes, because it's not how I feel about it. I feel optimistic and hopeful about this problem, and I feel very energized about this last year. It's been so gratifying to make people see this problem in a different way than I could do when I was just writing articles for the paper, and that seems to have worked a little bit in a small way that I haven't seen it work before.
I just want to reiterate why this basic, almost clerical job of recording the who, what, when, where, and why makes a difference, particularly in minority communities. Can you tell me what had been missing and why this has made a difference?
Well, if you think about it the other way, if you think about these deaths going unreported, I was thinking this morning about a father who was telling me about how he had desperately tried to block the blood flow out of his son's wound and it kept squeezing through his fingers, and that's how he knew his son was going to die. Stories like that that are just shattering for the people involved with them, shattering for everybody around them in a big circle, and yet a complete silence on the level of public discourse about what happened. It's frightening to people. It's creepy. I used to hear all the time, it's surreal how these homicides are not being covered. They're such enormous events in the communities they're happening in. So the very small thing that I did, and really in some ways sort of sadly minimal thing that I did, which is simply to write down the names and record these and make a public record of them, was something that people in the communities where the homicides were happening responded extremely strongly to.
And along the way of doing that, you actually created something of a database of the almost 900 homicides in Los Angeles County. Looking at that data, what immediately jumps out at you?
I covered homicides in Los Angeles County, and Los Angeles County homicides are sharply down this year. We just did a story about L.A. City, which is within L.A. County, having the lowest homicide numbers since the late 60s, early 70s. And yet, despite this, the distribution of homicide doesn't change. The homicide rate in America overall right now in the last few years has been 5 or 6 deaths per 100,000 people per year. In Los Angeles County, for black men in their 20s, it's 176 deaths per 100,000 per year. This is not a small scale of difference that we're talking about. It is extraordinary. I wonder if actually more important than the names on the homicide report was the decision to include the race of every victim. And in some ways, I wonder if the response that the homicide report got was more because of that than anything else, not just the names, but seeing a 20-year-old black man, a 21-year-old black man, a 27-year-old black man, a 32-year-old Latino man, a 21-year-old Latino man, a 21-year-old Latino man day after day, every day. I think it allowed people to see what the statistics on paper actually mean in terms of a daily toll, and that may have been more of its power.
In a couple of weeks, you're going to hand over the reins of the homicide report to a colleague. Any words of wisdom?
Well, I'm actually training my replacement, and it's his first job, actually, as a writer in the newsroom, which may say something about me or not. I think that affectionately, one of my editors referred to me as an overpaid file clerk at some point when I was doing the homicide report. But it really is more than that. It's a lot of digging. There's no way to get this information except to really, really work it and really dig. And he's finding that already. He said to me today, he said, you know, I put out a dozen calls on these cases and none of these detectives have gotten back to me. And I said, well, welcome to the homicide report.
Thank you very much and good luck on the new beat.
Thank you so much.
Jill Leovi is a reporter for the Los Angeles Times. She will step down as author of the homicide report later this month. High-definition TVs are this year's must-have item, so you'd expect movie fans to rush out and replace their DVDs with new super-sharp high-def discs. Besides containing incredible resolution and surround sound, they even offer cool web-based interactive features. But consumers are holding back. They don't want to be on the losing side of the war between the two competing high-def formats, namely Toshiba's, called HD DVD, and Sony's, known as Blu-ray. Consumers may soon be opening their wallets, though, because last week, Warner Brothers surprised the industry by announcing that it will be using only Blu-ray for its high-def releases. And this week, HBO and New Line announced they will follow Warner's lead. Cutting exclusive deals with movie studios has been the key to winning the war, and now with 70% of the market going with Blu-ray, it seems the hostilities have ended. Shane Bettner of Home Theater Magazine is in Las Vegas covering the Consumer Electronics Show, where everyone is buzzing about Blu-ray. So Shane, has Sony won?
I think that the widely held perception here in Las Vegas is that that is indeed the case. And let me back up for you and describe the events that transpired after Warner's announcement last Friday. Within a number of hours, the HD DVD group canceled its Sunday gala event, at which we expected to get its slew of new release announcements. And Toshiba still held on and did their press conference on Sunday, but I don't think I'm exaggerating in saying that it was an almost emotional announcement, stating that they were surprised that Warner had made this decision, that they really felt that the momentum they'd picked up in the fourth quarter of last year was very strong. And while HD DVD's current supporters, which are now reduced to Universal Studios and Paramount, while they haven't officially backed away from HD DVD, Paramount's exclusivity with HD DVD does have an out clause that apparently could be triggered by something like Warner's defection. And it's been reported by the LA Times that Paramount is going to make a decision within a month. And while Universal hasn't said anything, the fact is that silence is rather deafening.
There's no room for two formats to coexist.
It's not a secret that consumers, for the most part, have been confused by this. They've been reticent to make an investment in either format while the format war was raging and making that picture unclear. And I think the perception of many was that neither format would take hold unless there was one format.
In the Beta VHS battle back in the, I guess, 70s, Sony lost in part because Beta, while a higher quality format, was also significantly more expensive. But Blu-ray is also more expensive than HD DVD. Why isn't that an issue this time around?
The most salient fact in the last couple of months is that Blu-ray disc prices, while not reaching the low levels of Toshiba's HD DVD players, have been steadily dropping. The PlayStation 3, which is by far and away the most prevalent next-generation disc player on either format, you know, recently hit the $399 price point. They sold a lot of those over the holidays. And Samsung and Sony both had players that were selling for $299 or slightly less over the holidays.
Yeah, I was actually out at Christmas time shopping for a DVD player. And I was stunned to see it begin at $300, while ordinary DVD players, I think you can get, you know, for like 89 cents a dozen. And maybe I'm exaggerating a little bit, but can we expect that now that it has become the dominant format, Blu-ray costs will actually, you know, come down a lot?
You know, I'm not sure that that's typically how supply and demand works. In fact, I've already heard rumors that one of the lower-priced Sony players already went back up in price slightly. You know, one of the not-so-well-kept secrets of this entire format war is that both sides have allegedly been selling these players at a loss in order to gain market share. So it wouldn't surprise me if we see a little bit of a slowdown on the price drops.
Bill Gates was at the Consumer Electronics Show, and he was asked about the Blu-ray HD DVD battle. And he said it doesn't matter because soon enough, we're going to be getting our content from the internet anyway. Is all this commotion over what is fundamentally just an interim technology?
Yeah, I think that's the perception of most. What people have a harder time with is determining just how long that's going to take. You know, the perception of many, including myself, is that we just don't have a vast broadband infrastructure out there that can make the download model, particularly with high definition over the internet, a really practical venture for at least several years to come. And I think the perception of most of Hollywood studios is, you know, that while we certainly consume media in a number of different ways, from downloads to mobile phones to the iPod, I know that the studios in Hollywood are certainly looking forward to trying to sell their catalog on a physical media at least one more time. And Blu-ray disc and both HD DVD offered a really improved image and sound capability that I don't believe the internet will be ready to deliver for some time.
All right, Shane, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Shane Bettner is editor of Home Theater Magazine.
The internet internet is always evolving, but if there's one constant we can rely on, it's that the World Wide Web is worldwide. It is, after all, an inherently global phenomenon, and while we may not look at Chinese sites or outbid Laotians on eBay, we like to think we could if we wanted to. But now, the interconnectivity of the net may be at risk. The Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, or ICANN, is the group that controls the Internet, a U.S. nonprofit organization under contract to the Department of Commerce. ICANN has recently succumbed to pressure from China and Russia to allow the creation of domain names using non-Latin alphabets, like Chinese and Cyrillic. And, according to Columbia University law professor Tim Wu, that could mark the beginning of the end of the web as we know it. Tim, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Can you explain what ICANN does and how it exercises control over the net?
It's sort of like the authority that gives out medallions for New York taxicabs. That is, if you want to be on the internet, you need a number and need a name if anyone wants to find you. And if you want a number or a name, at some level, ICANN is in charge of processing those numbers and names.
It has an interesting relationship with the U.S. government.
The United States can potentially veto what it does. It's never tried that exactly, but the United States also has physical possession of the one root computer for the internet, which is somewhere here in Virginia, and it potentially could use its physical power over the root to try and do something.
What is the root?
It is the one computer that stores the domain names that work on the internet, .com, .net, .org.
And no one else has got it.
No one else has got it.
Is it no wonder that the UN-sponsored Internet Governance Forum concluded recently that developing countries were feeling alienated because they felt their interests weren't being recognized by ICANN? I mean, is it shaping up as a developed world versus developing world issue?
It is already an issue between the developing and the developed world. There's been some arguments that the United States has rigorously enforced the rights of trademark owners, and trademark owners tend to be corporations, rich American corporations. So that's one area where maybe there's a concern. There's also a sense that it's unresponsive, it's elitist, it's a group of American scientists and specialists and lawyers who basically run the show more or less behind closed doors. They can't really point to a lot of results, but they feel it's like a little club, and they don't like that.
So what is the alternative to ICANN administration of the internet?
There's two groups that are trying to challenge it. The first are the groups that are trying to set up alternative structure. They're sort of more like internet radicals that want to have their own domain name structure. The more sort of serious, maybe pernicious challenge is from Russia and China, both of which have made waves and have started to set up their own internets based on their language systems, Chinese and Cyrillic.
So what would the internet world look like then if China and Russia were to set up their own internet root systems?
It would be, in a word, balkanized. It would be a internet in name only, and in practice, a series of national networks where it's not easy to reach other ones.
Now, recently, ICANN has been allowing non-Latin letters in domain names. It was seen as a way to placate China.
Right. So this year, ICANN has decided for the first time to start allowing non-Latin domain name development. It's controversial. There's a lot of security concerns, and there's also just concerns that it's going to split the internet up.
This argument that ICANN is having with Russia and China, it seems as if it's foreign policy playing out in cyberspace. We saw cyber attacks against Estonia last year. It was suspected they were directed from Russia. Do you think that the internet is becoming a new field for foreign policy power plays?
Yes. I just came from a Defense Department meeting where we were talking about cyber deterrence and exactly these set of issues. And absolutely, there is a sort of new arena for tensions between nations, and it is the internet. Whether it's intellectual property, domain name issues, pornography or terrorism, a lot of these issues are turning into internet foreign policy. And so this is just a small example of a larger phenomenon.
How likely do you think it is that the internet will ultimately split apart into many, many different pieces?
I'd say if we get to a point where the Chinese internet only recognizes Chinese and you can't even go to American websites, that is really the death of the internet. That is no longer a network of networks, which is what the internet was. And the localization of domain names is an important step in that direction, towards an internet that is an America-only internet, a China-only internet, and a Russia-only internet, where you can't even get out of those internets. We're not there yet, but this is a step in that direction. Governments have to take an active role in trying to protect an interconnected internet. ICANN may have no choice to make this concession on language, and it's hard to say English should be the universal language without sounding like a neocolonialist. But we have to make sure that this one step doesn't turn into a true balkanization, because I think that would destroy the initial promise of sort of an Esperanto of the world and would be bad for all of us.
Tim, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Tim Wu is a technology and law professor at Columbia University and co-author of Who Controls the Internet? Illusions of a Borderless World.
Coming up, you might feel it, think it, talk about it with your friends, but when should journalists call a recession a recession?
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world. The William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism, offering a new one-year Master of Arts degree program for experienced journalists. Journalism.columbia.edu. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Feeling anxious, out of sorts? It could be the war, or politics, or seasonal affective disorder. But it could be something that begins with R.
First, there are more signs of a looming recession.
Are we headed for recession?
And if that's the case, economists say the risk of recession is over 50%. This is according to...
Yeah, well, you can say it.
Recession.
Recession. You can say it. It's okay. It's out there.
It
People
hurts
are talking
a little
about
bit.
It. I know.
Reporters and pundits may have determined that it's time to invoke the R word, but the White House certainly is less inclined.
There are signs that will cause us to be ever more diligent and to make sure that good policies come out of Washington.
Recession has always been the economic forecast that dare not speak its name in the West Wing. Here's a clip from the defunct TV show of the same name in which a White House aide explains why.
We don't ever use that word around here.
What word? Recession?
No!
If we say it, we give it credence.
What should we call it?
I don't care. Call it a boat show or a beer garden or a bagel.
So if it is a bagel, the Fed thinks it's going to be a mild bagel.
But it shouldn't be hard to call a spade, or a bagel, right?
Depends on what your definition of a recession is.
Well, it's two consecutive quarters of negative growth.
I could make a pretty cogent argument that the employment population grows at about 1%, and if GDP falls below that, then by default you're in a recession.
Okay.
Okay, it can be confusing. That's why the government relies on the private and independent National Bureau of Economic Research to make the official call. But the NBER's definition of recession is even fuzzier, calling it a significant decline in economic activity lasting for a few months. And the data it uses to make that determination take between 6 months and a year to compile and analyze. In 2001, they didn't call it until after it was over. Meanwhile, the pundits bloviate.
I think we could have what I might term a selective recession.
Yes. Slowdown, yes. Recession, no. Global recession, no.
Sit down here and put my name on the line and say recession early 2008.
Dean Baker, economist and co-director at the Center for Economic Policy Research and a blogger at the Liberal American Prospect, says the media wait too long to use the word because they're inclined to view things through the rose-colored glasses of Wall Street economists.
Yeah, you know, just to give you a very concrete example, in the fall of 2000, just before the last recession, I was looking at the blue chip 50 forecast. You know, so 50 people ostensibly making independent forecasts. Not one of them saw a recession that was less than 6 months away.
Baker acknowledges the risks of using the word too soon, but he thinks the media are more often guilty of applying it too late.
You know, failing to see a recession coming, failing to call it after it's here, we get people make wrong decisions the other way. So we have a lot of people that get the new car or new house, and then they end up losing their job. So we haven't really done those people a favor.
But Dan Gaynor, director of the Business and Media Institute, part of the Conservative Media Research Center, says the liberal media, biased against the current administration, are all too eager to tell the awful truth about recession, even when it isn't true.
And so if you want to acknowledge that they're finally using it when it's right, you have to similarly say that when they used it in 2004, 5, 6, and 7, they were wrong.
Gaynor and Baker don't agree on much, except this. When the media invoke the R word, they affect how we feel and how we act. Baker says that's good.
We're starting to see that already. Many of the members of Congress are discussing stimulus packages. President Bush indicated that, you know, they're thinking about a stimulus package. He hasn't decided to support one, but, you know, there's discussions of this. And if people start to use the R word more frequently, that's likely to push those discussions along much more quickly.
But Gaynor says the media too often make self-fulfilling prophecies. For example, in September, when ABC ran a report called The Road to Recession, based on what turned out to be faulty job numbers. When the numbers were revised,
you didn't see them recant. They just continue to report more recession stories. So when you watch the Consumer Confidence Index and you watch that drop, how can you not connect the dots and see that the one's affecting the other?
We called David Wessel, the Wall Street Journal's economics editor, to see where he stands on the tug of war over recession. He says newsrooms aren't nearly as powerful as people think.
I personally think that we are a much better reflection of what's going on in the economy than a cause of people being depressed. So when you see the consumer confidence numbers falling, I think it's because people are actually worried about their paychecks and their job security and their health insurance. But there are people who allege the opposite. So we try very hard not to fall victim to what we're accused of, which is emphasizing the negative and not the positive. Sometimes the people are making predictions because it's a good way to get attention. Sometimes they make predictions because they happen to be from the party that's not in power. And at the paper, we try and be very careful about how we use the word. I happened to write a column in the Wall Street Journal, and I wrote a column where I said I thought we were going to have one. But the reporters I work with wouldn't say that until we actually had some hard evidence.
Right. And what is that evidence for the Wall Street Journal?
Well, think of yourself as being in a car with a blindfold on, and the car starts to go down a hill. You can feel you're going down a hill, but you don't really know whether that's just a little dip in the road and you're about to go up again, or whether you've reached, the Rockies on your way down. Well, that's sort of the way we are when we think about a recession.
Now, it's a great analogy, but what's the evidence before a paper like the Wall Street Journal decides there's a recession?
Well, we would look at largely at the government data on the economy, things like the unemployment rate, something called industrial output, which is the amount of stuff made by factories in the country, and in the monthly numbers on how much money people have coming into their bank accounts, their paychecks and stuff like that. And if you saw all those start to go down, we would be pretty convinced we were in a recession. But I want to emphasize just how hard it is. Back in 1990, we now know the recession began in July. But in August 1990, we were writing that economists were divided about whether the economy entered recession. We quoted Alan Greenspan as saying he didn't think we were having a recession. And so even though it was well underway, at the time it wasn't obvious.
We were speaking to Dean Baker. He was saying that economists tend to emphasize the positive and that this could affect the way the economy is reported.
Well, I think what Dean means is that economists aren't as pessimistic as he usually is. I do notice a kind of strange tendency among the economists, though, which is to put the odds of recession at 45%. It's sort of like they don't have the guts to say we're in recession, we're going to have one. They get the odds up to 45%. I wrote a column that said, I expect to be looking back at explaining why we had a recession in 2008. Some economist cornered me at a conference I was at and said I was too pessimistic, and it turned out he put the odds at 45%. And I said, okay, my odds are 52%, yours are 45%, we have some big disagreement. It is true that you have to look at where the economists live. If you live on Wall Street, you may have a different point of view than if you're a factory worker in Ohio. I think what makes this period sort of interesting is Wall Street is having a pretty bad time, so we've noticed quite a bit of pessimism from Wall Street economists rather than the optimism that Dean thinks he usually sees.
Could you give us a little peek into the newsroom? If you guys have a meeting or a discussion or an exchange of email or some sort of forum wherein you decide whether or not the word recession will be used in the news pages.
My experience is at some point, some editor in New York will ask at our morning meeting or in an email to me, do we know enough to say flatly that the economy is in recession? Just like you don't need the weatherman to tell you that it's raining outside, the Wall Street Journal can say it's raining. We don't have to say according to the National Weather Service. At some point, we will feel confident enough to say the economy appears to be in recession or something like that. But we're not there yet.
Were there lessons from 1990 that you're applying to the current case?
What I find interesting in going back is how long it took us to figure out what was going on. And that is a bit frightening. We actually have a whole lot more data than we used to in real time. The computers have made it much easier to sort of take the instant pulse of the economy. And to the extent that we can get information from people, or if not real numbers, get a clues from them, we'll use it. We have a story, prominent story, talking about how AT&T, the phone company, said that it noticed an increase in people not paying their phone bills and disconnecting their phone line. That was one of those early warnings that makes you wonder, wow, maybe things are really getting worse. And sometimes economists deride that as anecdotal, but, you know, we're journalists. I look at anecdote as the singular of data. They don't go out and talk to people very often. They just sit there and look at these numbers and make educated guesses. We try and take the best of what they do and the best of what we do to give people a full picture.
David Wessel is the economics editor of The Wall Street Journal.
All around the Union Square is the land of the daily work. You'll see them standing everywhere, reading the daily work. You go in the door of a soda store and talk to the soda jerk. He knows the truth about the war by reading the daily work. You go
to. If I am giving comfort to our enemies, I ought not to be in the Senate. If, on the other hand, Mr. Murrow is giving comfort to our enemies, he ought not to be brought into the homes of millions of Americans by the Columbia Broadcasting System.
Senator Joseph McCarthy, in April of 1954, on Edward R. Murrow's television program, See It Now.
And I want to assure you that I will not be deterred by the attacks of the Murrows, the Lattimores, the Fosters, the Daily Worker, or the Communist Party itself.
Ed Murrow, author Owen Lattimore, Communist Party head William Foster, they would all outlive McCarthy, and so too would the Daily Worker, which ceased publication, at least in its original daily form, 50 years ago this weekend. Founded in 1924, the Worker was the de facto house organ of American communism, echoing the party line from Moscow and touting a global Marxist ideology. Vernon Peterson is a historian of American communism at the University of Great Falls in Montana. He says the Daily Worker started out a pretty drab affair.
Well, in the very beginning, it was primarily an in-house organ for the Communist Party, publishing a lot of party documents and pronouncements that came down from Moscow. And it was really pretty dry reading. But in the 1930s, when Earl Browder came to be party chairman, that's at the point the Daily Worker really started to orient itself towards a general audience, trying to do things that would appeal to the common man. And they were particularly unhappy with Franklin Roosevelt when he was first elected.
Yeah, let me talk about that, because Roosevelt, I would say, is universally regarded as our most socialistic president. But the Daily Worker, I guess he wasn't pink enough for them. Tell me what the paper sounded like on the subject of FDR.
Well, in fact, I've got an excerpt from an article from 1932 commenting on Roosevelt's New Deal. It says, "The policy of Mr. Roosevelt's party is identical in all essences with that of the Republican Party. Mr. Hoover could be a member of Roosevelt's cabinet, or vice versa." And there's a series of headlines I gathered. This one says in bold type, "Wall Street, Roosevelt bill passed by House robs tens of thousands of vets and members of the armed forces." Or, "Loot reaches $7 billion as banks fold up. Hoover and Roosevelt shaped plot months ago." In the early days, they were not happy with Franklin.
Certainly, at least through the late 20s and into the 30s, communism was regarded by many Americans as just a global fight for social justice, and therefore in some ways were sympathetic with its goals. The people read the Daily Worker and even subscribed to it, Was anyone's life ruined during the McCarthy era for having subscribed in their naive youth to the Daily Worker?
Well, in fact, subscriptions to the Worker could get you in a lot of trouble in the 1950s. One of the more famous ones, though, actually rebounded very badly on McCarthy. There was a black woman in Washington, D.C. named Annie Lee Moss, who was a member of the Communist Party in the 1940s. She wasn't a particularly good member of the party. She rarely attended meetings. But in 1954, Annie Lee Moss was working for the Pentagon as a code clerk. She just translated things from one machine to another and wasn't privy to any classified information. But McCarthy picked up on this and denounced her as a security risk. They brought her in to testify before his Senate committee. The poor woman was really made a pathetic figure on the stand. She was only about 5'2". I think she weighed maybe 100 pounds. They had her bundled up in a coat, and she was wearing a hat. She looked like she was very nervous and possibly quite ill. The major evidence they had against her was a party card and the evidence that she had subscribed to the Daily Worker. She made such a compelling figure that McCarthy realized how bad things were going and actually left in the middle of interrogating the woman and left the whole thing to Roy Cohen, of course, who was notorious for his bad treatment of people on the stand. This is one of the things that led directly to the Army-McCarthy hearings and McCarthy's discrediting, even though, in fact, Annie Lee really was a communist.
By any measure, did the Daily Worker do journalism as we currently define it?
I would have to say that even though it took a very ideological line in its coverage of strikes and some of the grassroots movements, it did very much practice journalism. For example, during the 1934 San Francisco strike that led to the formation of the ILA under Harry Bridges, the party had a number of people in San Francisco at the time who were sending back dispatches to New York so that they could be turned into articles. And these were very much like the kinds of immediate reporting that other people were doing. The party always had to put a spin on it to try and present events in the way that they felt people needed to understand them, but a lot of mainstream journalists do that as well.
There was one sports writer at the Daily Worker named Lester Rodney who played a fairly pivotal role in breaking the color barrier. Tell me about him.
Lester Rodney is really kind of the epitome of the changes that took place in the Daily Worker during the Popular Front period. Previously, the editors didn't like the idea of sports coverage because that seemed like a bourgeois pastime and just something to distract the workers from the real job of revolution. But in 1936, Rodney came on. He was a self-taught journalist. He'd been a sports writer at his high school, joined the Communist Party, and parlayed his early high school experience into a job as their baseball correspondent. Man loved the sport and was given a fairly wide range to write freely about what he saw as the problems in baseball and especially the segregation of black players. He championed the career of Jackie Robinson for 9 years. Before Robinson was actually brought onto the Brooklyn Dodgers.
What do you think are the biggest misconceptions about the Daily Worker?
I guess the biggest misconception would be to think of it as just this strident, completely irrelevant publication. It actually had a place in American culture and society for a long time. During the height of the Popular Front, it attracted a number of very good contributors. Woody Guthrie occasionally contributed columns on music. Richard Wright wrote about things happening in Harlem and in the black community. And for a time, they even had a comic strip called Little Lefty that one of the contributors did, a man named Harvey Kurtzman, who later went on to edit Mad Comics, which turned into Mad Magazine in the 1950s.
Little Lefty.
Little Lefty. the paper's high point, you know, I would say would have to be between 1956 and 1958 when it stopped publishing. At that time, John Gates was the editor. He had had a lot of serious criticisms of the Communist Party after Khrushchev made his famous speech to the 20th Congress. He opened the paper up, and people began writing serious editorials, questioning party policy, and doing the kind of things that you really do in a popular press. Of course, Gates then was thrown out of the party, and the paper ended its run shortly after him.
Vernon, I appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Vernon Peterson is a historian of American communism at the University of Great Falls in Great Falls, Montana.
You go to a dance to look for romance, a waltzing or mazurka. You have a chance to catch their glance by reading the Daily Worker. The Eskimo, the Hottentot, the Chinaman and the Turk, they know exactly what is what by reading the Daily Worker.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Vuolo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Paul Schneider. We also had help from Andy Lancet, Jessica McGowdy, and Ian Whitehead. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism, offering a new one-year Master of Arts degree program for experienced journalists. Journalism.columbia.edu. Support for On the Media also comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and listeners of WNYC. This is NPR.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.